Welcome to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm April Wolf. Every week, I invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, director, actor, or producer, and we talk in depth about one of their fave genre films, perhaps one that influenced their own work in some small way. And today, I'm very excited to have screenwriter, playwright Claire Kieschel with me. Hi, Claire.
I'm so happy to be here.
For those of you who aren't as familiar with Claire's work, please let me give you an introduction. Claire is a bi-coastal theater maker and film and TV writer. She earned her BA from Amherst College before jumping up to the New School of Drama for her MFA. Since then, she's stayed very busy, receiving commissions from Actors Theatre of Louisville, South Coast Rep, and the Alley Theatre. Her plays include Paul Swan is Dead and Gone at the Civilians at Torn Page, Sophia at Alley Theatre All New Festival in 2019, with an upcoming world premiere at the Alley in 2020. She's also brought sci-fi to the stage with Pilgrims at the Gift Theatre, which got a spot on the Kilroy's The List in 2016. Her cabaret musical Lulu is Hungry with composer Avi Amon. Went to Ars Nova's Ant Festival, and she also wrote a play called Some Dark Places of the Earth, which was inspired by her child. Oh, wow. You have a childhood in Belgium?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. I was like, I knew that I put that in there, like a childhood in Belgium. Though theater is wildly lucrative, Claire gave all of that up to switch gears a little bit for a while and write for TV. She wrote for Netflix's second season of The OA, for which she was recently nominated for a Writers Guild Award for her episode Mirror, Mirror, and also wrote for HBO's Watchmen. For that, she is nominated for a Critics' Choice Award and two WGA Awards. So it's been a nice run.
It's been a good week. Yeah.
Yeah, it's been pretty good. So now she's stacked on HBO Max's upcoming feminist retelling of Greek mythology, Circe, based on the Madeline Miller book. She also helped develop the House of Dragons Game of Thrones show in a mini room and is developing a sci-fi dystopian pilot with Annapurna and E1, as well as writing a film for Disney with Secret Machine. So
yeah.
A lot of stuff coming up, right?
Yeah, it's been busy.
So you're just going to go right back to plays, right?
I think so.
Okay.
Actually, I honestly think that plays sort of saved my life because I think that TV and film, I mean, I came in here having done exclusively playwriting for so long that when I got to TV and film, I was like, oh, like you don't get final say at all. I didn't understand that. So I kind of think that like playwriting is great for my ego because I can give everything to everyone else in like a TV room. I don't have to worry about my own ego and like getting my ideas on every single page. And as long as I have my plays, I kind of have that little outlet.
Yeah. Theater's weird. It's fun.
It's weird.
Claire, the movie that you chose to talk about today is Brazil.
I did.
Can you give us a little explanation on why this is one of your fave genre films?
Yeah. Well, I think it is one of those films that, like, although I might have some different feelings about it today, when I was a kid, I saw it, and it sort of changed what I thought film could do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's Terry Gilliam's best work. I love his world building, especially, and I feel like, especially thinking about The OA and Watchmen, both of those have so much world building that I thought of Brazil while I was in both of those rooms as well. And there's something just, I feel that it's talking about right now. Like it's one of, I think in the 1980s, we had so much crazy sci-fi and, you know, like the fact that we're living in 2019, which is the year of Blade Runner,
mm-hmm.
Watchmen was also 1985, which was also this film. Like everyone was like trying to process this really weird America in like a weird future world.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Brazil is actually the one that got the closest to what we actually are today. And so I think, lots of other reasons. It's also a Christmas film, like your film, Black Christmas. So for people who don't like Christmas, Brazil or Black Christmas would be great.
Yeah, I was rewatching it today. And I was just like, oh, shit, it is a Christmas movie.
It is.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Bad and Die Hard.
yeah. I mean, add it on the list, man.
Exactly.
For those of you who haven't seen Brazil, today's episode obviously will give you some spoilers, but as always, that shouldn't stop you from listening before you watch it. My motto is that it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching still. If you would like to pause and watch Brazil first, go ahead.
Yeah, 2.5 hours later.
It is a long movie. Now let's introduce Brazil. Written by Terry Gilliam, Tom Stoppard, and Charles McKeown. That's a nice trio right there. And directed by Gilliam for release in 1985, Brazil stars Jonathan Pryce as Sam Lowry, a government grunt who dreams vividly of rescuing a gorgeous damsel. One day, a printer gets jammed with a dead fly and accidentally prints out a wrong name on an arrest form. Buttle instead of Tuttle. All hell is going to break loose. Agents swat the apartment of Buttle, pulling him from his family, leaving a handful of paperwork.
I hereby inform you, under powers entrusted to me under Section 47, Paragraph 7 of Council Order Number 438476, that Mr. Buttle Archibald, residing at 412 North Tower, Shangri-La Towers, has been invited to assist the Ministry of Information with certain inquiries.
But upstairs neighbor Jill Layton, who looks exactly like Lowry's dream woman with short hair, takes it upon herself to get Buttle released from his wrongful imprisonment. When Jill tries to make this report, Lowry spots her, but Jill is not in a mood to talk to government grunts.
I've been to information adjustments. They sent me here. They said you have a form I need to fill out.
Have you got an arrest receipt?
Yeah.
Is it stamped?
Stamped?
No, there's no stamp on it, you see. I can't let you have the form until this is stamped.
Where do I get it stamped?
Information adjustments.
Later, Lowry's AC gets busted, so he calls in a complaint. But suddenly, a renegade repairman played by Robert De Niro, the actual Tuttle of this story, swoops in to save the day.
I called Central Services.
But they're a little overworked these days. Luckily, I intercepted your call.
And Lowry has to make a decision to protect this man or turn him in. He protects. Sam takes a promotion to information retrieval, which is the only way he'll be able to find out information about his dream lady, Jill. He gets her info and then spots her in the building and takes off with her in her cab. She tries to get rid of him, not trusting him at all, but he holds on for dear life, earning her trust the hard way after suspecting her of some terrible things. Lowry makes nice eventually by showing Jill that she's now listed as deceased to the government.
You don't exist anymore. I've killed you.
Thereby removing her from the bureaucratic grid, they make love but are interrupted by government agents arresting Lowry. He's brought to a facility where Jack tortures and eliminates, quote-unquote, problems.
Jack, I'm frightened.
Oh, how do you think I feel? You shit!
Jack!
Shut up!
This is a professional relationship.
But a resistance group swoops in, kills him, and rescues Lowry.
You okay?
Tuttle!
Call me Harry.
Tuttle and Lowry escape, and Lowry's taken on a strange tour through the city and a funeral before he falls through a casket and into Jill's car, which drives away into the sunset. Of course, then it's revealed that those last parts are all in his head, and Jack has successfully eliminated the problem of Lowry.
It was very well done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. That's there's a lot of other stuff that happens.
Yes, yes.
There's a lot of scenes that I didn't fully explore in that synopsis, but that kind of gets to the meat of what actually happens in terms of plot. I want to talk about the process of whittling down an idea to its kind of essence of what you need in a story. Gilliam said, quote, I work in this strange sort of magpie approach. I just start collecting things and having an idea, a central idea, works like a magnet. Things just start sticking to it. I might end up with basically all these ideas that I start shuffling around like a jigsaw puzzle, trying to make a story or some sense out of the thing. Seems like a maddening way to work, but this is just his process.
I kind of love it. I mean, I feel like I'm a little like a magpie as well. Like I, especially when I'm not doing an outline, I definitely feel like I collect. And then at mm-hmm. the end, I'm like, okay, what do I have?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And yeah, it results in things I think that are like kind of unexpected and dreamlike, which there's so much of just random scenes in this movie that like are not about the plot but are just so delightful. And that restaurant scene, I don't know mm-hmm. if you like that scene, but that's one of my favorite scenes of it. And it feels like it's been collected from somewhere where it's like, okay, he's basically having dinner with his mother, who's talking about her She got him a promotion. He's very angry about it. Her friend got some new facial surgery.
Mm-hmm.
And meanwhile, the waiter's trying to get him to say the number of the meal that he's supposed to order. And then there's just a terrorist event. And everyone just goes off on the rest of their day and goes off on the rest of the meal. And it's just such a normal occurrence.
Really, Sam? Won't you do something about these terrorists?
It's my lunch hour. Besides, it's not my department.
Something like that, I feel like if you were structuring this film just for plot, you might not put that scene in there. But it says so much about the world in which you're just understanding that this is a world that is more of a metaphorical world that is mm-hmm. about how we ignore things and how we just go on with our lives, even though there's like these terrible events that we're hearing about and are surrounding us every day.
There's actually like a meta-ness to that scene, because this is Jonathan Pryce talking about the restaurant scene. Quote, "The restaurant scene we shot at Mentmore Towers, the home of transcendental meditation."
Oh my God.
Ironically, it was one of our more violent scenes. You've got wealthy people eating at the restaurant. The explosion goes off and they carry on with their meal. At the time, it was so big and violent, I thought it had gone wrong. I couldn't believe the size of the fireballs.
What? Oh my God, you just blew my mind.
Yeah, so it was this like really kind of horrific, violent thing. You've got these people who are just kind of like in their own kind of like wealthy, privileged, zened out state of just like not paying attention to anything around them. And yeah, it was like a kind of a big shock for all the actors who were filming it, too, who were just like, oh, just keep going on.
They didn't even know it was going to be that big. That's an incredible story. Oh, Jonathan Pryce, you pulled it off.
Yeah, he's the only one, I think, who has like some kind of reaction on
exactly.
that. But like Catherine Helmand,
who
plays his mother, is just like very cool. Very cool. Just keeps going on.
Can't you do something about these terrorists?
Well, I want to draw attention to, and this is something I don't have a quote to back up, but the idea that the production design of these kind of futuristic worlds where technology is supposed to help us achieve all these great things, it's actually very clunky, as you say. It's just as the dialogue can be clunky and these kinds of things, that the machinery is clunky.
Completely.
It doesn't work and it seems off, and it doesn't seem like it was designed for like ergonomic, like the best of what the future is, but it is what just ended up happening. So it's just this kind of not pristine vision of what technology in the future or in an alternate world looks like.
It's that weird combo. And I mean, I think that Watchmen has a little bit of that where it's like, we don't have internet, mm-hmm. but we have like a lot of clones and other fancy technology that like teleportation devices. But the thing I love about Brazil is that, it's this weird, it almost feels like we're living in a world that already had its heyday maybe like a couple decades ago.
Yeah.
And like was at the pinnacle of technology and innovation. And like, and then what happened was that all of a sudden the bureaucracy drove out the imagination and like will of anyone who could actually come up with better ways.
Mm-hmm.
So they're all living in this sort of like deformed, society that everything used to work, but no one actually has the skills or imagination to make anything work. And the bureaucracy makes everyone like so exhausted that they can't even bear to do anything but survive.
Yeah.
Which maybe that's what maybe that's what it feels like to be in America now. I don't know.
Yeah. It's a kind of like there's a weird anti-intellectualism about it. You know,
like
try not to be smarter than this. Just be like, be at a minimum to medium level of intelligence, because
that's
you're not
going
to survive here if you're smarter than that.
That's such a good point. I didn't even think about that. But like Sam Lowry, he's almost too competent for the world. It's like he actually like is trying to be someone who is really passing by on his mediocreness.
Yeah. And he would like to. It's just that he's like slightly smarter, and that sucks.
Just the like all those tubes, right? Like the idea that like it's just incredible. It's like above, like behind the very Jetsons like exterior, everything is just chaos. Like
mm-hmm.
and all the hero, the Indiana Jones of this world is Robert De Niro, who is a heating specialist who just like wants to do his heating fixing without. paperwork. I just
love that.
That's
the hero.
Yeah, that's the hero of
just
the story.
Just a guy who just is so tired of paperwork.
Right. And he's the only one who's sort of like, he keeps repeating that mantra that like we see on the billboards, everyone, where, which is what it's like, we're all in this together. We're all in this together. And he's the only one that like believes the bullshit that the society has actually like advertised, but is actually doing something about it,
yeah.
Which I love. I love his relationship to Sam Lowry. It's so weird.
But we're going to take a quick break. So we'll be talking a little bit about Robert De Niro and then also Tom Stoppard being a part of this, which
crazy.
I love the way that he talks about his relationship with Terry Gilliam and how they worked on the script together. We'll be getting into that and a whole bunch of other stuff, but we'll be right back.
Hey, we're Ben and Adam, and we're here to tell you about our Star Trek podcast, The Greatest Generation.
Why should I listen to a Star Trek podcast? You may be asking yourself. Well, ours is actually good and funny.
We joke around, we have a lot of fun, we talk about film production techniques that are used in Star Trek. We love to break down the stories and the characters, and we just have a blast while we're doing it. It's kind of like sitting around with a couple of buds, having a beer, and talking about an episode of one of your favorite shows.
So go to MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe to The Greatest Generation.
Yeah, whatever you're using to listen to this, just have it find us and subscribe.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Claire Kieschel, and we are talking about Brazil. You talked, we talked a little bit about the love story and about Jill's character and him,
yes.
him not really seeing Jill for who
right.
she is. And so we should definitely talk about
Let's
Jill
talk about
and
that.
Kim Greist. When she was working on the film, she said, it's the depths of the psyche, the unconscious uglies, the things you run away from, the things you don't want to see, right? So she was really in love with it. The rumor is that her part had actually been cut down significantly because Gilliam wasn't happy with her performance.
Oh, wow.
The thing is that he had auditioned quite a few leading actresses from that time to be this character of Jill, but he wanted someone who was somewhat inexperienced because he wanted to be able to kind of mold their performance on screen.
Ooh.
So the only movie credit that she had to date when she booked Brazil was actually Chud.
Amazing
in 1984.
Film. Amazing film.
And so Chud is a classic.
Oh, my gosh.
And I'm not even sure if Terry Gilliam had seen it, but he was just like, okay, well, the audience won't have any prior expectations of her and who she is. He wanted kind of an unknown, for just like, I want to build her up to be this character, and she's going to be a dream projection for him. So here we are. But he said later on that when her material had to be reduced, he said, quote, that experience really does count for something. So,
oh my God, trash talking Kim.
Yeah, he really did trash talk Kim.
Very nice. And I don't know, I also just don't think that, I don't know if that's really fair to be like, I want someone that I can mold and break. I think it's such a hard part, actually, like, because there is so little on the page, and maybe that's just because the cut. Of how much they cut of her stuff.
Yeah, but we will never know
we'll never
what
know.
Her role actually was.
Yeah, and I think she does a lot with what she can, Like, she does, you sort of, I what I like about her performance, especially in the beginning, is how much she just, like, does not want to play his games. Like, Jonathan Pryce's character keeps being like, I love you. And she's, like, kicking him out of,
like, nope.
cars and vans and trucks and just, like, get out of here. I have nothing to do with your fantasy. And then once she starts to, like, acquiesce to it, it feels kind of weird and bizarre and almost like that's part of his, fantasy version mm-hmm. of him. The fact that he can't, I always felt so bad is that, like, she's like, okay, maybe let's, sleep together. I'm here. And he's so wrapped up in his, like, hero fantasy, saving princess fantasy that he has to, like, run off. He can't even consummate the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only, like, when he comes back and she's wearing his mother's nightgown and maybe one of her wigs,
mm-hmm.
or maybe that's just in his hair head, because we don't see that wig on the bed when they get caught. But
yeah.
It's so fucked up.
Yeah, I'm not going to say that Terry Gilliam is always great with women.
Yes. Not his finest, hour.
He's got a spotty record, and this character, the women in this movie are pretty. interesting.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know what's weird about it is that I feel like part of it feels, yeah, like they all are kind of characters of themselves, except for maybe Jill. The mother, certainly, and all her mother's friend.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so cruel to sort of like older women and their desire. I mean, he's definitely poking fun on like vanity, even though I kind of do love this idea that you have these like dueling surgeons that are like going farther and farther and farther and making his mother younger and younger and younger.
Yeah.
Like that's so fucked up in such a delicious way. But I think what's interesting to me is that I feel like the film is kind of, it's so knowledgeable of like what it's doing about, you know, the kind of movies everyone's watching. Like everyone's obsessed. It feels very like everyone's watching their iPhones, except they're like weird little screens. And, you know, Kim's watching her movie in the bath and they're all watching Casablanca.
Mm-hmm.
Like they're in this like romantic mode where he's projecting on everything. And he feels to me like he's in this like hero's journey. That's all his fantasies at the end. And like the truth is with a hero's journey is like the woman has, you know, what Joseph Campbell basically was, you know, apparently once asked, like, what's the heroine's journey? And he said the heroine doesn't have a journey. She's like the place that the hero gets. She's the place that the hero gets to.
Mm-hmm.
And like that's what this in a lot of Gilliam's movie feels like. The female characters are sort of like a boon as opposed to like a fully fleshed out character.
Yeah. And this one, I would say I think that I'm always viewing it beside 12 Monkeys, too.
Oh, yeah.
And those two films and what they have to say about love. Because Gilliam said, quote, "To me, the heart of Brazil is responsibility, is involvement. You can't just let the world go on doing what it's doing without getting involved. And of course, what Sam does is he falls in love. So he falls vulnerable and his whole world starts falling apart. Never fall in love."
Oh, my God.
That's what the movie is about for him.
No.
Is never fall in love.
But Terry Gilliam just says things. Like, that's part of, like,
he's
Terry Gilliam.
He's inflammatory.
Well, he's also just, like, I feel like he's just, like, a trickster character in that he'll say something in one interview and the other interview will say completely the opposite. So you can never quite trust anything that he says.
No. Next one, he was just like, it's actually just a traditional love story.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, never fall in love. I guess. I find it sort of a romantic film. I mean, not in my kind of romance, but I think that for Sam Lowry, like the only escape he has in his mind through, you know, this bureaucracy mm-hmm. is his fantasy of love.
Well, how do you write romance? Washman just had aired, you know, by the time this show airs, the entire series will be the first season will be done, and the romance at the center of this movie is really delicate and really interesting on the screen in a way that I don't think we usually see in TV. So why does it resonate? How do you make something that resonates, a love story that resonates?
Yeah, I mean, I just saw the final cut of episode 8 last night, mm-hmm. and I thought it was such a beautiful love story, and I actually haven't seen 9 is the only one that I haven't read or seen.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how it ends. I mean, I know part of what it does, but I don't know how the love story will play out by the end. But I think why 8 feels so, I think that like longing is always at the heart of any love story. I mean, I think that it's the thing that we all understand on such a primal level. It's not togetherness. It's often separation. It's mm-hmm. often that I can't be with that person. And then for me as a playwright, I think something that I always think about is like, what's the moment or thing that connects characters? My teacher used to call it in grad school was always like, it's the red coat moment where like, I don't even know where she got that from, but it's like the moment where you realize that this person was kind of made for you, or that their trauma equals your trauma or somehow fits together,
mm-hmm.
that it's a true recognition, and you have to find a way to dramatically illustrate that. And I think in Watchmen, it was hard because we had to figure out how Dr. Manhattan, him understanding Angela and Angela not knowing him, like he had to sort of like play this game in a way that was, you know, what is he willing eventually to sacrifice for her?
Mm-hmm.
And that we ended up being like, we can't actually do you can't be in a relationship with someone who knows everything, who knows the future, who's always thinking about the past and the future and the present simultaneously at all times. I mean, that would be the worst boyfriend. And he mansplains all the time.
And I think that I think that episode also illustrates how bad that would be.
You don't want to be a superhero's like girlfriend. Like, he's not in the comics, he's not a good boyfriend. He keeps leaving his girlfriends for 16-year-olds. Not understanding emotional, he sort of doubles himself and makes himself a clone to give his girlfriend a threesome without her consent. And she's like, what the fuck? What are you doing? So he's not someone that has a lot of EQ. So I think we had a fun time distinguishing between what Cal was like and what Dr. Manhattan was like, mm-hmm. and where they sort of fit together. And just that Angela and Dr. Manhattan both really have experienced a lot of trauma in their lives and a lot of loss. And ultimately, Angela expects everything to go wrong. Everything in her life has, her parents have died, mm-hmm. her grandma dies. That's just what she expects. So weirdly, a man that says this will end tragically in 10 years actually aligns perfectly with her own knowledge of of course. Well, that's always going to happen.
You're Well, it's better than not knowing.
Exactly. She hates not knowing, right? She hates that ambiguity. Yeah. And Cal wants, Dr. Manhattan wants that ambiguity. He actually is I always know. And so the thing I want is that, can I just for 10 years pretend not to know anything, mm-hmm. and actually experience what it's like to be a human.
And the OA also has its own kind of different types of love stories. It's not necessarily a traditional sense.
Absolutely. I think the thing with the OA, which was so funny, because we were in that writer's room for part two, and we had some writers. We had an older white male writer who was very, very lovely, very, very smart. But he kept being like, why does everybody like Homer? Homer's so lame. Obviously, the OA, Prairie, should get together with Kareem. He's so much sexier. He's the detective. Why would she even, care about Homer? And what we realized was that, Homer is the princess. He is, in the fantasy, he is up in the turret, and OA has to save him. Mm-hmm. And, that's actually the gender flipping that we're just not used to seeing in stories, that it's not a physical, their relationship is actually all about the fact that they spent 7 years together falling in love without being able to touch. And it's that longing and that separation, that goes back to primal, mm-hmm. Pyramus and Thisbe or Romeo and Juliet. It's so ingrained in our psyche of oh my God, they want to be together, but they can't be together. And just increasing that in every world that that OA and Homer are, is that they're so close and yet they still can't get together. Mm-hmm. And the fact that Henry couldn't really, he eventually understood that, but it because we don't see that a lot in film and TV, it's not an archetype that we naturally understand away.
It's a paradigm switch.
Yeah.
We talked a little bit about playwriting, so let me bring up Tom Stoppard's quote. He said, quote, "I think he only came to me," that's Gilliam, "because the whole thing was a lot older and the pages had just gotten flattened out, and he wanted somebody to stir them up a bit and see what came to the surface. Mm. Terry would like to have met more often, talked more often, and I didn't want to do that. I just wanted to talk to him a couple of times, take the whole thing away, and have him trust me for a couple of months, and then he'd get 120 pages back, for better or worse. For more people would like to meet twice a day with the writer to have a draft in the morning and a new one at night. Terry considers that the director is the ultimate author. He'd just say, that's fine, when we're shooting, I'll be on set, and I'll be the one who's writing it." And I said, okay, that's fine, but today, let's get it on paper. Most writers dream of directing their own scripts. It's why many directors write their own scripts, even if they're the ones who can't write.
Oh, my God. Tom Stoppard speaking truth. Wow.
He says it so matter-of-factly. He's like, Terry's great, but you're going to do whatever you want, but let's just get it on the paper. He's like, I haven't seen the new script. I don't know what they ended up shooting, but...
I think that's one of the reasons that, as a playwright, I'm drawn to TV, is that, there is more of, an authorial presence. Mm-hmm. Damon Lindelof is very much, here's... here's my vision. And like the directors are my co-collaborators, and that he really works with his directors, but it is like one sort of primary vision,
yeah.
With a writer's group, a room obviously to support that. And yeah, there's something I think about, Britt and Zoll that do the same thing that I really admire. I mean, I think it's also like directing for film really feels like directing is writing in a lot of ways, which is maybe why, I feel like there's a lot of writers who, including me, who are like, oh, I do want to one day direct so that I can have Final Cut.
Yeah. I mean, like Final Cut. Wow.
Wow. Can you imagine?
Wow. Can you imagine? we're going to take another quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about the varying surprises in every scene and being met with nervous executives and the idea of liking all of your characters.
Ooh, love it.
We'll be right back.
Judge John Hodgman ruled in my favor.
Judge John Hodgman ruled in my friend's favor.
Judge John Hodgman ruled in my favor.
I'm Judge John Hodgman. You're hearing the voices of real litigants, real people who have submitted disputes to my internet court at the Judge John Hodgman podcast. I hear their cases, I ask them questions, they're good ones, and then I tell them who's right and who's wrong.
Thanks to Judge John Hodgman's ruling, my dad has been forced to retire one of the worst dad jokes of all time.
Instead of cutting his own hair with a Flowbee, my husband has his hair cut professionally.
I have to join a community theater group.
And my wife has stopped bringing home wild animals.
It's the Judge John Hodgman podcast. Find it every Wednesday at MaximumFun.org or wherever you download podcasts.
Thanks, Judge John Hodgman.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Claire Kieschel, and we're talking about Brazil. So, burying surprises. Here's what Terry Gilliam said about this. Quote, I find that most films are a little bit like fast food. I mean, you have them, and it's fine, and it's over, and it's done with, and that's the end of it. And I like the idea of going back and rediscovering or discovering new things all the time. It's partly this thing of trying to create a world, certainly a world with some within some logic. And you've got to have all the things in there. A telephone isn't just a regular telephone in my movies, though. It does things, and it becomes a character that our protagonist has to deal with. To me, that's what life seems to be about. It's dealing with things. Either they help you or they get in your way. They frustrate you. They drive you crazy. You spend your life trying to make money to buy them so you can serve you. And then they don't serve you properly. It goes on and on. I think we're living in a fairly materialistic world. That's why things are so important in it.
Oh, my God. That's so beautifully articulated.
I like that. I think that his idea of populating scenes with things that have a life that are part of the world is it kind of owes itself to the process that he has. I have another quote in here that I can probably find if I look hard enough. But he's really interested in having people from all parts of all the departments come up with ideas for other parts of the departments. You know, he's always looking for more ideas. He said, quote, I just try to break that system down by trying to get everyone involved in doing everything on the film. So the costumer is coming up with ideas for sets, and the set designer might be coming up with an idea for the costumes.
Wow.
You try to get the right team of people to feed it, and then they feed you, and it goes back and forth. I think that's why there's so much detail, because people are thinking about it, and the detail becomes as important as the characters in the film. So he and his team, and he tends to work with a lot of the same people, they're thinking about it in terms of how can we create every piece of this frame has a kind of character in the objects that exist in it.
The production design is incredible in this film, and I feel like it, you can see its influence in so many other films, but like just in terms of the objects, like remember when you're talking about these things that like have dual purposes, there's that desk that he like shares with his office mate.
Yes.
Well, there's like a wall in between their offices, but they share a desk that they keep like pulling back and forth. And it's just incredible. And it's all you need to like explain how annoying like a coworker is next to you that's like blasting their music too loud.
No dialogue. It doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. It's so, and there's a lot of those little details that you're just like, oh my God, like all the Christmas gifts that they have, like how weird, and like everyone has the same Christmas gift that they keep giving to everybody else.
Jack the Torture has a whole pile of them. He's just like, Merry Christmas, you know? He's just like, anyone who comes by gets the same fucking Christmas gift.
Oh, my God. Yeah, and his mother's house is just incredible. And, like, the whole production design of, like, how that bureaucracy works, or that casket that is in his imagination full of, like, jelly bones.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so gross.
I think that, you know, sometimes I get exhausted watching his movies, but I think that that's what he wants, in a sense.
Oh, yeah.
Because if you get exhausted, then your eye might stop moving around the frame, and you might miss some things, but then all of a sudden you watch it again, you're like, oh, I'm looking at a different spot in the frame.
Exactly. It has that level of detail. I mean, we had really amazing production designers and costume designers and everything else on both OA and Watchmen. But Watchmen, I think, is like filled to the brim with like just references and Easter eggs and tiny little things that like it rewards that kind of, I feel like we're in the, you know, for some shows, you're in this like Reddit mind where it's like you want to give that kind of fodder to the fans who want to look at things mm-hmm. and like discover stuff. And I understand it because I kind of like have to watch an episode sometimes twice and I, you know, wrote on it. But I'm like, oh, I feel like I missed some of that. And now I have to go back because it's so dense.
Mm-hmm.
And for some people, like my mom, it's too much.
It's like, honey, I love you.
What
but
is happening?
I really don't know.
yeah. But I think that's the thing about Gilliam, you know, and all these, it's like, I don't know, you only can make a movie or a TV show for yourself and for like people, you can only do it for, it's hard to do it for everyone. And I think Gilliam really does make movies that like make him, give him pleasure.
It is, it's an interesting, I mean, I like thinking about your career and the weird things that you're doing because I do think that you're really only making things for yourself.
Yeah.
And then other people are just like, yeah, I'm on that train, you know?
Yeah.
So you're just happy when someone jumps on the train with you. You're like, oh, great. We're all a bunch of weirdos.
I mean, I think it's, you know, I know like we're in this age of vertical integration where like all these companies are coming together and now everybody's like, well, we want Game of Thrones where it's four quadrants and everybody watches it.
Mm-hmm.
But I find that like the stuff that I like the best is like the weirdest, like Los Espookies on HBO where I'm like,
great show.
What an amazing show. Who is its audience? Is it just me? You know, like,
mm-hmm.
and that feeling, I mean, I was talking to Britt about, you know, like when OA, you know, I think OA was very popular the first season with like women 25 to 55.
Mm-hmm.
And like, oh, I'm so sorry. You're only popular with women 25 to 55. And it's like, is that a bad thing? What if we just like make things for that market? Like, actually, isn't that kind of an exciting thing? Like Watchmen, I think people were really like, is this just for fans of the comic book?
Yeah.
But I think that specificity makes it so that people, even if they don't know the comic book, are able to like feel the depth and richness that like, oh, this is being made for someone like me or someone like that I want to be.
Yeah. I was not familiar with the comic book.
Oh, really?
Or the original movie, and I understand it.
Okay.
I'm a thinking human, you know?
I'll tell my mom.
Tell your mom to give it a chance.
She is. She's super supportive.
Oh, that's really sweet. So I wanted to talk about Terry Gilliam and his idea of liking all your characters. He said, quote, strangely enough, the characters in Brazil I actually like.
Hmm.
I don't agree with them. I don't approve of them. But I somehow feel that they're all trapped in a world of their own making. Even the bad guys, the shock troops. One takes his helmet off and he's talking about his eyebrows. I left that in just because I wanted to give those guys a moment, too, of being human beings and their own little sets of problems. They're very polite, but they still bash his brains out. I think at times I despair at the way things are in the world, but I haven't given up. That's the idea.
Wait,
of
what's
like,
the part with the eyebrows?
So there is a little moment where like those, the troops, like the little SWAT guys,
yeah.
like they're in a car, they're like in transport. And like one of the guys, like they've got their helmets off. And the guy's just like, oh, I just keep sweating. It goes into my eyes. And the guy's just like, I've got big eyebrows. And so what it does is it diverts off into my ears.
Oh my God, I forgot about that.
And so it's the dumbest little thing, but he's just kind of made sure that every character had some kind of human moment in this very inhumane film.
I don't know. I mean, I think I have a hard time with the word likable when mm-hmm. it comes to characters because I think it often has a lot of weight, especially around female characters,
mm-hmm.
that it's often a word that people are like, she's not likable enough. And like the same thing that a man would do, a male character would do, is something that people start to worry about when a female character does.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I like this idea that like it's like a fondness is what it seems like he's sort of talking about.
Yeah.
Is that if you're fond of your characters, if you see them all as human, if you're not judging them, like even in the midst of the SWAT team, that you're letting them also show little glimpses of like just their weird humanity. Mm-hmm. It kind of helps us, I think, believe in the world more.
I mean, in terms of what you've been doing in playwriting and writers' rooms, I mean, how do you guys approach that kind of fondness characteristic?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was something that we really, I mean, it's so funny. There's just all these, it's so much of a balance of like archetypes and like what we expect from a character and just making something feel really real in whatever character that is. So like Laurie Blake in Watchmen, like we knew that she was going to be likable because I think that people always like the kind of like acerbic badass woman mm-hmm. who is like, oh, like, you know, she's always commenting on all how everything else is dumb. Like she's our like audience surrogate. So
she's like Daria.
Yeah, exactly. So even though if she's a little bit, we like the way to balance that her, yes, she's kind of an asshole, but she's likable because she's also voicing the same things that the audience might feel.
Mm-hmm.
And I think with Angela, like that was a little bit harder because she's keeping so much inside and keeping so many secrets. And so it was like a balance of like, how do you show a character that is not, revealing everything and mm-hmm. then like letting us into that character more and more as the season goes on.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think we didn't talk that much about like her likability, but it was like just the question of like, I think we like active characters. And so how do we keep people active? Like
yeah.
I think there's a weird thing that like as an audience member, you're always excited by the character who's making choices and who's doing things.
Yeah.
And if characters get too passive, that ends up being the thing. Even if they're doing like kind of weird, you know, messed up shit, we'll be on their side as long as they are like pursuing something.
Yeah.
And with the OA, it also felt like kind of a similar thing in terms of like how do we continue to make Britt's character as active as possible.
And also, I mean, I would say like in terms of Britt's character and Angela, you have two characters who have an unknowability.
Exactly.
Both that we don't know them, but also that they don't know a lot from their past.
Totally.
And so it seems like that's a really nice kind of trick is that to get to know them, they actually are getting to know themselves. So they don't have to reveal anything and betray their character of being, because we are all learning at the same time.
Completely. And I think that they're both detectives, actually, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like both Angela and the OA are sort of detectives also of their own lives.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so true that, Regina's character is like has to go investigate her grandfather's past to understand herself in the same way that like she has to like, and that's the only way that Angela understands who she is,
mm-hmm.
is by understanding where she came from. In the same way, she has to like integrate that experience in the same way that like, the OA is actually sort of like repressing Nina. She's repressed the like consciousness of the body that she's come into, and the only way that she can like get to the next side and like grow and discover what's actually going on is by embodying and integrating this body that she's suppressed, this like and pretending to be Nina and integrating this other consciousness and understanding like who this person would be if she had lived in this universe.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, they weirdly I feel like we watched a lot of Vertigo because it has a lot of like you're the femme fatale and you're the noir detective. What is that in one person? What is that in one character? Like, how do you do that?
Well, it's nice that you have a thread going in your work.
Yeah, I didn't think about that, but I do think that I'm even in my plays, I'm really interested in like how you surprise yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as a writer, I'm always interested in like those moments in which you're like, oh fuck, this is why I'm writing this play or this movie or this scene, and you don't even. The things that I feel most compelled to write are the things I don't know why I'm drawn to or why mm-hmm. I need to write them. And if I did, I probably wouldn't write them in the first place because I would already have the answer. So it's the process of writing and getting through it that I answer a bigger question about myself or about some other concern that somehow relates to me.
It's therapy,
isn't it?
Thank you so much for coming on the show,
thank you,
Claire.
So much. Thanks
and
for having me.
People should be able to see your stuff coming up on HBO soon, and then take a look, check out your Disney
Cersei
movie
will
that you're
be
going.
Coming up in HBO Max, like you know, next year or the year after. Who knows? TV takes a long time. But I'm also on Twitter and Instagram as Claire Kieschel.
Wonderful.
Thank you so much for having me. This was great.
Thank you for listening to Switchblade Sisters. If you like what you're hearing, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you do, we'll read it on air. If you want to let us know what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at SwitchbladePod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. Please check out our Facebook group. That's Facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of MaximumFun.org.
Sam, won't you do something about these terrorists?
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.